I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Having delayed the decision until after the November election, the Obama administration is expected to decide about an expansion of the Keystone Pipeline sometime this year. If built, it would deliver some 800,000 barrels of bitumen, or tar sands crude oil, a day from Canada to refineries in Texas on the Gulf Coast. Proponents contend it would have economic benefits for the United States by creating jobs, reducing reliance on oil from the Middle East, and lowering gas prices at the pump. Critics say the benefits have been exaggerated and have concerns about potential environmental hazards like spills and increased greenhouse gas emissions. Well, today on Radio Times, we get two different perspectives on the Keystone Pipeline, and let me introduce our two guests. Susan Casey Lefkowitz is Director of the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. And Susan Casey Lefkowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Amy Myers Jaffe. She's Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis, joining us by telephone. And Amy Myers Jaffe, nice to have you with us as well.
Yes, nice to be here.
I know that both of you have different opinions about various aspects of the expansion of the Keystone Pipeline, but I want to begin with tar sands crude oil to see if there is some consensus on what we are talking about. And Amy, if I could begin with you, how would you describe the tar sands crude oil?
Well, I think that for the public to understand, the way it's produced is different. So we have heavy crudes that are produced by pumping them out of the ground. The difference with oil sands is that they're actually mined. In other words, it's mixed in with sands either right at the top of the surface or slightly below the surface of the ground, and it has to be heated with steam to allow the process to remove the oil from the sand. And that is carbon intensive in the sense that it takes heat and power from natural gas. So that's a sort of an extra step that produces more greenhouse gas than, say, the kind of oil that might be produced in offshore in Texas and Louisiana.
Do you agree with that, Susan?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, what we basically see with tar sands is a new kind of oil extraction. And Canada is the first place it's really happening intensively, but there are deposits of this unconventional oil, oil that is sort of not your grandfather's oil, all over the world. And the oil industry is going after it in a sort of gold rush mentality, where I think that often health and environment and the issue of how we can deal with climate change if we continue expanding our demand for oil really aren't taken into account.
But Susan, are you saying that this is a dirtier form of energy than oil that's gotten, let's say, out of the Gulf of Mexico?
That's right. It's more energy intensive to get out of the ground. And so it has higher carbon emissions from the production process. But then bigger picture, we also have to look at where we're going, as a world, in terms of what kind of energy we're going to be using in the future, especially given the very severe threats of climate change that we're facing.
Amy, I'm curious about whether you share some of Susan's concerns about the kind of environmental impact of just mining this oil, this crude oil.
So let me just say that there's some technical problem, and I can't hear what Susan's saying.
Oh. Well, you know what? We got to fix that. And let me just say to our engineer, Amy cannot hear what Susan is saying, so we need to get that fixed. And I apologize to you, Amy. So let me just put the same question to you. Whether you share some of the concerns about the environmental impact or even the potential, I guess, degradation of just mining the kind of tar sands crude oil that we've been talking about.
I think my problem is not so much with, does it have environmental impact? I mean, everything we do to produce energy has environmental impact. For example, the disposal and production of solar cells has some destructive environmental impact because there are some toxic chemicals that are involved, and how the waste from them is handled in China is a really big environmental concern. So I think what we really have to focus on is, do we need this resource? If we're not going to use this resource, what will we use instead? And, are the oil sands more environmentally degrading than burning coal from a power plant or you know, the problem of the disposal of nuclear waste. You know, I think that you have to look at everything relative to each other, and then we have to look at our total energy system. And what I tell people about blocking the Keystone Pipeline is you have to remember and think back, for example, to what happened in this country in the 1970s. Environmentalists were deeply concerned about the possibility of the spill or the environmental impact on ecosystems in Alaska for building the Alaska Pipeline. And so instead of building the Alaska Pipeline in the late 1960s, we didn't build it. And then we had the 1973 oil crisis, and then we built the Alaska Pipeline. So the point is, had we built the Alaska Pipeline in 1967 when it was first proposed, in 1973, we wouldn't have had the Arab boycott because it wouldn't have had any impact on us because that had been tried in 67 unsuccessfully because we had enough oil in the United States and therefore the Middle East players were not powerful enough. And so we do have to take that into consideration. And the oil is moving by rail car, and we have oil moving around this country by truck because environmentalists blocked the pipeline. And so all the emissions from these tar sands and all the other mining impacts on water and other resources is going to happen anyway. It's just going to be worse because it's going to be moving around by diesel trucks, which also cause greenhouse gas emissions. It's going to be moving around by rail, which is a greater chance of the spill. And so we really have to ask ourselves the fundamental question, which is, are we willing to use less oil? Because the only way to keep the oil sands in the ground is to use less oil.
Well, and I feel a little weird because, Amy, I'm not sure. I want to put a question to Susan to have equal balance here, and I'm not sure that you're going to be able to hear it or not, and we've got engineers working on it. Perhaps we can call Amy back or try to figure out how to hook our guests up because it's a bit of an odd situation here in that one can't hear the other. Susan, were you able to hear Amy?
I was, and Amy said a number of points that I wanted to try to unpack a little bit. So, you know, first of all, when we look big picture at where we're going with our energy future, we do face real choices. And Amy's right that the fundamental thing that we need to be looking at is how do we reduce our dependence on oil. The good news is that in the U.S., we have been reducing our dependence on oil. Fuel efficiency standards have been a big part of that. They've helped consumers have lower gas prices at the pump, and they've also really reduced our dependence on oil. You know, when you look at Keystone XL, one thing that Amy said that I would take issue with is Keystone XL is not about the current production of tar sands. It's about the future production. It's about the expansion of having even more tar sands come out of the ground. And what we're seeing is that is not happening because Keystone XL has not been built. There are not other paths for tar sands to take to get out to the coast for export, because that's what Keystone XL really is, right? It's not a pipeline to bring tar sands to the U.S. markets or the Canadian markets. We already have a lot of pipelines doing that. Tar sands is already coming into our Midwest and our Rockies and throughout Canada. Keystone XL is about exporting tar sands to overseas markets where the oil industry can get higher prices for this very expensive to produce product. And those pipelines don't exist right now. Canadians are saying no, they don't want to take the risk. And so, you know, Keystone XL is sort of the main chance right now for the oil industry to get tar sands to overseas markets.
But are you also...
That's not really true.
Go ahead, Amy.
It is clearly true that the oil from North Dakota, because Keystone Pipeline isn't picking it up, is moving around this country by truck and rail. And indeed, that will be the alternative if the pipeline is not built. All of that oil will move because there's a market for it, and it'll move to the United States. And the bottom line is companies like Shell have offered to put in or planning to put in carbon capture and sequestration technology. And so I think the point is to really focus on why do we pick Keystone XL and not why are we not focused on coal where it has extreme impact on the environment. And the reason is the coal lobby is so strong, like the NRA, that the environmental movement is afraid to take it on, and so they pick a weak player like a Canadian pipeline for a symbolic win. And, you know, they're putting at risk right now future supply that's needed. Now, if it's not needed, there won't be demand for it, and the pipeline, the oil will sit under the ground if it's not needed.
Let me just...
I think the point is, it's whether it's needed or not.
Well, let me pick up on something that Amy said and put it to you, Susan. What she's saying, that even if the pipeline isn't built, this crude oil can be trucked, it can be put on trains, that doesn't necessarily, I guess, stop the delivery of this fuel.
Yeah, what we're actually seeing, and it's interesting because financial and industry analysts are confirming this in Canada, is that projects to develop the tar sands further in the future have been put on hold because there is not the ability to move this stuff to overseas markets. And what we're really seeing is that there is a discount right now on the price of the tar sands product in the markets where it exists because there's a glut. There's too much of it. And so, what the oil industry is really looking for is to relieve that glut and move more of it overseas so that overall they can make more money off of tar sands and they can, it's so expensive to get tar sands out of the ground that it basically isn't worth it to the oil industry. It's not economically viable to go after it unless you can access those overseas markets. And, one other thing that Amy said that I want to take issue with is this issue of sort of coal versus oil. I would argue that both of these are very powerful industries. We're not talking about one small Canadian pipeline company. We're talking about the oil industry. It's every major oil industry player that is taking tar sands out of the ground right now. And the environmental community in the U.S. and internationally is tackling both coal and oil because we know that to fight climate change, we need to take on the fossil fuel industry. And in fact, one of the big other demands out there of the Obama administration right now from the environmental community is to say, let's get those carbon standards in place on coal-fired power plants, both for new and existing coal-fired power plants. It's another extremely important step that we need to take to fight climate change. But we also need to stop dirty fuels. And the first decision that we see coming up on that is rejection of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline.
And Amy, we're about 45 seconds before our first break here, but do you agree with Susan when she says that the real market for this oil is a foreign market, not the domestic market here in the U.S.?
I do not agree with that at all. There are some refineries in the United States that are configured to only to run a very heavy crude. In other words, they can't run the kind of crude that comes out of North Dakota, and they'd have to make special new investments. And so there is a demand for this crude inside the United States. Some of the players that are producing it in Canada own refineries and want to bring this crude to their own refineries. So I would disagree with that assessment. It's very expensive to bring oil all the way from Canada down to the United States and then put it on a boat. And that's not really the economics. The economics is, and the reason why we have crude oil moving around this country by rail and truck is because there's demand for it in the United States, and that demand is so high and people are willing to pay so much that we can afford to do it by truck.
Well, let's take a very short break.
I would disagree with the economics.
We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Amy Myers Jaffe and Susan Casey Lefkowitz. We're talking about the expansion of the Keystone XL pipeline. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, LD Entertainment, presenting the thriller Disconnect, a film about ordinary people struggling to connect in today's wired world. Starring Jason Bateman and Alexander Skarsgård, starts Friday at Landmark Ritz at the Bourse and Rave Ritz Center.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers minimally invasive procedures designed to help people overcome strokes and brain aneurysms. Physicians use interventional techniques through small incisions to help speed recovery. Patient stories at abingtonpowertoheal.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're hosting a debate today on the pros and cons of the expansion of the Keystone XL pipeline. We have two guests who have joined us. They can now hear each other. And Susan Casey Lefkowitz from the Natural Resources Defense Council and Amy Myers Jaffe from the University of California at Davis. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Susan, one of the arguments, I guess, for, if not the Keystone Pipeline, or certainly the expansion of the Keystone Pipeline, is that if it doesn't come to the United States, it'll end up in another country like China, and China has worse environmental regulations and standards than the United States. Does that hold up from your perspective?
You know, it really doesn't. It's interesting. China is definitely an investor in the tar sands, but so far they have not shown themselves to be a buyer of tar sands. And when you look at the proposed pipelines that are sort of on the table to cross British Columbia to go to the West Coast so that tar sands could be taken to China, those simply aren't moving forward. There's a lot of opposition from the public, from local communities, but especially from the Indigenous communities in Canada, from First Nations, who have real constitutional rights to say what happens on their land. And they're basically saying no to the pipeline, and they're saying no to the large oil tankers that would be needed in the very difficult to navigate intercoastal waters of British Columbia. So ironically, Keystone XL actually is the best chance for tar sands at this point, if it were to get approved, to go overseas to Latin America, to Europe, and also to China. What happens is the refineries in the Gulf Coast take that heavy tar sands oil, and diesel is one of the main products that it gets converted into, diesel and gasoline. But diesel is a big export product for the United States, and that's most likely to be going overseas.
Do you think, Amy, from your perspective, that if the Keystone expansion was approved, that that would have an impact on gas prices here in the United States?
Well, I think you have to look at the oil market as a swimming pool. So if we put a water in one end of the pool, the level of the whole pool comes up. So to the extent that we hold oil off the market, it makes gasoline prices go up for everyone, including Americans. So it really would depend on whether is the oil going to stay under the ground or not. I mean, it raises costs a little bit to have it move around by truck or rail car, but I think, marginally less than when you just don't produce something. So really, the market's going to determine whether or not this oil is needed to be refined. And to the extent that there's demand, then it'll be produced. And Susan pointed out at the beginning of the show that our automobile efficiency standards were starting to kick in, and that is true. Eventually, over time, as those strengthen, we will have lower gasoline prices in this country because demand is going to continue to fall. And those of your listeners who are paying attention to the show, if you care about climate change, you personally should be, next time you're buying a car, upgrading to a more fuel-efficient car. Not just for the economy of it, but, also for protecting the planet.
But do you think, from your perspective, Amy, that tar sands has a more deleterious effect on the environment than other forms of fuel?
It depends what form of fuel you're talking about. I mean, everything has a deleterious effect. And if you're asking me if, tar sands has a more deleterious effect on the environment than, say, natural gas, you're probably not, right? Or compared to solar, probably not. But compared to other things that we use to generate electricity in this country, maybe it's not quite as bad. So, I mean, you have to really look at the impacts. You have to look at whether those impacts can be ameliorated. I will give the environmental movement gold stars for the fact that in pointing out the higher greenhouse gas content in the production process, that they have gotten some of the oil companies to adjust their process in a way that making it, you know, much more environmentally friendly. And I'm sure if they keep pushing for that and get Canadian regulation to focus even more intensely on that, they will be successful. Mm. The government of Canada has already phased out the use of coal in all of Canada. So it's kind of ironic. Here we are in the United States telling the Canadians that they should have a climate policy when we don't even have one here in the United States. And I resent the fact as an American that our own environmental organizations are pressing a foreign country to have a climate policy when we don't even have a climate policy here in the United States, and they're not effective in implementing one here in the United States.
Well, let me give Susan a chance to weigh in on that. Then I want to talk about jobs. But Susan, go ahead.
You know, when we look at the issue of climate change, this is clearly a global issue. And I think that, you know, it is the it's very important that environmental groups that are based in the U.S. work with partners in other countries all around the world to be doing everything that we can to work together to fight climate change. And one thing that we see that's critical, I would agree with Amy, is to have American leadership in fighting climate change. And that's not something that we're seeing a lot of on the global stage. What we are seeing is real steps in the United States to tackle climate change, like the fuel efficiency standards, like we hopefully will see if we get these carbon limits on power plants. But we also need to see the U.S. stepping forward and taking a strong stance when it comes to dirty fuels like tar sands. You know, not that long ago, the European climate commissioner was here in the U.S., and one thing that she said very clearly is that we need U.S. leadership on climate, and part of that leadership needs to be in taking a stance against dirty energy projects like the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. It's, you know, important that we do all we can to move forward with clean energy. It's important that we tackle coal, but we also have to be tackling oil. And that's something that, as a world, people are really just starting, I think, to focus on, that means saying no to the dirty, as well as thinking about ways to lessen our dependence by things like fuel efficiency standards for cars.
And that's Susan Casey Lefkowitz. She's director of the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Also with us is Amy Myers Jaffe, executive director of energy and sustainability at the University of California, Davis. We are talking about the proposed expansion of the Keystone XL pipeline. It's a decision facing the Obama administration. It's been around for some time now. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we get to our callers, I am interested in your different perspectives on whether this is a job creation project or how many jobs you think would be created if the Keystone expansion gets the green light. Amy, how many jobs do you see?
I think there's been a lot of exaggeration about how many jobs would be created. Obviously, anytime you have a major construction project, it creates jobs. And, you know, I've seen estimates in the hundreds of thousands.
Right.
But, you know, we all know from the stimulus package that the roads and bridges element didn't create quite as many jobs, lasting jobs, as expected. So, you know, obviously, anytime you have economic activity, it's going to create jobs, and I'm sure there are lots of jobs to be lost. What I would say, sort of more to the point on the jobs issue, mm-hmm. is that when we experience an oil supply disruption in the Middle East, there are millions of jobs that get lost all around the world, in Europe, but also here in the United States. And we saw jobs get lost in 2007 when we had a dislocation in the oil market. But, you know, the experience in the 80s was that our economy got crushed for years because we weren't properly positioned.
Are you saying jobs don't sort of matter, or that you have to look at it in a more global perspective?
I think you have to look at it in a global perspective. It's not just how many jobs will this particular pipeline project create for 3 years. And, you know, when people say, well, it doesn't matter because it's only a job for 3 years, you know, if you're one of those people having the job for 3 years, I guess it matters a lot. But it's also just, you know, why do we care about having secure oil supply? I mean, I agree with Susan, you know, we need to move to a system where we're using less oil and less coal, and where we're, you know, moving to cleaner fuels. But the bottom line is, at this 2 minutes, we all have 350 million liquid fuel cars that require fuel that's made from crude oil, and we either we're going to not use them or we're going to have some oil.
Where do you come down on this job situation, Susan?
Well, the State Department that did its draft environmental review of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline is very clear on the jobs numbers. So I agree with Amy. There have been wild exaggerations that mostly come from industry. But what we see from the State Department's analysis is 35 permanent jobs from this pipeline and approximately 3,900 construction jobs from this pipeline. You know, that's what we're looking at in terms of jobs. This is a project. It's not an economic recovery plan. And I think we need to be very clear about that, that every job is an important job, but we can create jobs for our country in the clean energy sector that both are, you know, helpful and good in terms of climate and health and our children's future, and put food on people's table and give them real jobs, both in the construction sector and in terms of permanent jobs. And Amy's also right. We're looking at the potential for a loss of jobs as well with this pipeline. We've seen most recently in Arkansas with the spill of the Exxon pipeline, spilling, you know, tar sands, that we've again been reminded that tar sands pipelines, when you look at the numbers, they tend to spill more often. And one thing we know for sure, especially from the spill that happened in Michigan back in 2010, is that once tar sands spills, it is much more difficult to clean up than conventional oil spills. And a spill along this pipeline's path, which crosses major aquifers and rivers, really critical farmland for the United States, could mean a lot of job losses in terms of our farming communities.
Well, and picking up on the spills, Amy, and then we will get to our callers. And I wonder what lessons you take away from this most recent spill in Arkansas.
I think the problem is, you know, when we learned this in the airline industry in past decades, it's not okay for the oil industry to have as its standard spill prevention. They need to have zero tolerance. They need to be high-reliability organizations that train their personnel that an accident is just not acceptable. And we do. We have a tremendous amount of accidents all around the industry. And clearly there's some gap in either training or procedures or safety culture across the industry. And, you know, sometimes the industry likes to talk about the so-called weak players. But this recent spill was ExxonMobil, which has, you know, supposedly the best safety practices in the industry. So the industry has not, in my opinion, really stepped up to the plate to address the routine pollution, the routine accidents that they have in their operations. And that routine, everyday pollution and accidents really does need to be remedied. Or we are going to get to the point where there's going to be more and more regulation on them. In Canada, there is now a regulation where if a company shows a high record of accidents, the Canadian government can actually send a consultant into their operations and regulate that they have to have more safety officers or more environmental specialists, and they can actually change the composition of the company because they considered it such a problem that they had to put that kind of onerous regulation in.
Susan, I'm looking at something from the Department of Transportation that last year in the United States, there were, looks like, 364 pipeline spills.
Yeah, the pipeline spills are a real problem. Our country is crisscrossed by pipelines. And, you know, their safety and maintenance is a real issue. When you look at something like the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline and think that it could have a higher likelihood of spilling and that once it spills, it could be more dangerous for our waters and our lands, that's a really grave concern. And it's something that has mobilized people, especially along the pipeline path, to speak out their concerns about the pipeline. We've seen, for example, a lot of activism pushing back on the pipeline in Nebraska, where the pipeline would cross through the Ogallala Aquifer, even in its rerouted path.
Let me get, looks like Mark from Huntington Valley to join our conversation. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm calling because of some of the discussions that have not occurred on this, particularly from Amy, and that is the destruction of major part of the boreal forest in Canada to get this very dirty fuel out of the ground. And also another thing that is seldom discussed is the health and safety of the workers all the way up and down the whole cycle of these fossil fuels. Coal industry, oil industry, gas industry, workers are exposed to horrible conditions toxic chemicals. They die early. They get sick. The industries discount this. They hide it. People aren't getting the story on this.
Well, Mark, I appreciate
that's a comment.
No, I'm glad you called in. Let me give you a chance, Amy Myers Jaffe, to respond to his comments. What do you say?
Well, I mean, there's no question. If you look at the petrochemical industry and the refining industry, there are a lot of toxic chemicals that need to be handled. And I imagine that the statistics, I mean, I recently moved from the city of Houston, and cancer rates and asthma rates all around the ship channel where there's a concentration of refining and petrochemical, I mean, there is clear evidence of that.
Mm.
And, you know, again, it gets to both the operation of the industry and what is considered acceptable, whether we as Americans consider it acceptable or whether we don't. And some of it's convenience. You know, when you go to the grocery store, you know, do you put your fruit in a plastic bag or do you put your fruit in a paper bag? And do you recycle? You know, and some of it's habit, but some of it's just the basic operation of our economy. But I do think that the industry talks about all this, you know, heavy regulation, and, you know, you hear people stand up and say that we should abolish the Environmental Protection Agency, and somehow they have this counter proposal that they can self-regulate. And clearly they can't self-regulate. And well, clearly we don't have adequate safety measures put in place. The number of refineries in the United States that leak benzene, the number of people don't realize, the number of gasoline stations in your own local community that leak under the ground is actually a pretty high percentage. And so, you know, in the airline industry, we would not tolerate it if once a month or once every couple of weeks there was an airplane crash, right? And I don't know why, as a society, we tolerate this high number of accidents. I mean, it's not acceptable because even though people don't die instantly so often, that does happen sometimes, but over time, of course, it's affecting all of our health.
Well, let me give
you... We do need to focus on that.
Well, let me give you a chance, Susan. We're almost up in a break here, but Amy's saying, why do we tolerate this? Good question.
It is a good question, and I agree completely with what Amy has said on this point. I wanted to get to Mark's other point, though, on the boreal forest, and say that he's absolutely right, that the boreal forest is one of the last great wilderness forests in the world. We don't have many of them left, where you still have, you know, great herds of caribou and just a huge expanse of trees. And what actually happens in the tar sands is they, you know, to get at this gooey stuff deep under the earth, they have to scrape away the forests and the wetlands. They call it overburden. And it's simply scraped away and piled up, and what we're actually looking at in the boreal right now is extinction of the herds of caribou that live in this part of the boreal where the tar sands are. And we're also looking at a deep pollution of the boreal and the communities that live there, which are a lot of indigenous communities who are starting to suffer health effects from both the air and water pollution from tar sands extraction.
And that's Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the International Program, at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Also with us, Amy Myers Jaffe, executive director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California at Davis. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series supports WHYY, presented by Widener University, and continuing its sold-out season at the Kimmel Center on April 15th with Nando Parado. Sponsored by WHYY and BNY Mellon Wealth Management.
PA Wine and Spirits Premium Collection Stores support WHYY. Chairman Selection Wines offer a collection of varietals and vintages chosen by wine professionals. Signs bearing the Chairman Selection seal can assist customers in choosing a fine bottle of wine. New selections arrive regularly in PA Wine and Spirits Premium Collection Stores and online at finewineandgoodspirits.com. PA Wine and Spirits Premium Collection Stores support WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg responds to critics and is cheered by supporters of her lean-in philosophy for women at our recent sit-down. We'll bring it to you. Also, what's really going to happen to healthcare premiums under Obamacare? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. One of the closely watched issues this year is what the Obama administration is going to do about the proposed Keystone XL pipeline expansion. If it were passed, it would deliver hundreds of thousands of barrels of bitumen or tar sands crude oil from Canada to refineries in Texas on the Gulf Coast. We're talking with Susan Casey Lefkowitz and Amy Myers Jaffe and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Susan, I'm curious about how you see the Obama administration on this issue. President Obama talked in his State of the Union address about the threats of climate change. He has certainly talked about him and taken some steps to make the country more energy efficient. What kind of pressure do you think he is under in making this decision one way or the other?
Well, I think you're right that it's become clear that President Obama is seeing climate change as a major risk and something that we really have to figure out how to tackle in the United States and globally. He's spoken about it several times, and this comes after several years where we've really felt the impacts of climate change here at home in the United States. You know, this is not something anymore that's happening far away or in the future. It's happening here and now, and we're seeing it on the impacts in our health and also in the extreme weather events that we've had with droughts and wildfires and violent storms and floods. So all of that said, you know, we're making good progress on fuel efficiency standards in the United States under the Obama administration. We are on the brink of having regulations on carbon pollution from power plants, very important next step up for the Obama administration. But I think that what's hardest to do is to say no to specific projects, even very dirty energy projects like the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. And what's important to realize is that saying no, not just to this one pipeline, but to sort of a world of dirty energy projects is going to be really critical if we're going to tackle climate change in the way that the president has committed to do.
Amy, I'm curious about how, I guess, you see the president or the White House having to make this decision and pressure coming from both sides.
I don't envy the president. We also have to consider our relationship with Canada. Canada feels strongly about not having its infrastructure blocked by its neighbor, the United States. And, of course, Canada has an actual climate policy as opposed to the United States. What I would say is the president needs to show leadership, and that I think what's important is not that he blocked the Keystone pipeline. I think what's important is whatever decision the president makes about the pipeline, he needs to make it in the context of a package of either legislation or executive orders that address this issue of climate. And again, the question is not, will he say yes or no on a particular symbolic project? Because in the end, if he says no, he's not going to, in my opinion, lower greenhouse gases at all. What he needs to do is come up with something to offer the American people and the global community that shows our commitment as Americans to lowering greenhouse gases, and he needs to put it forward in a package of things that he's planning to do, not some little piecemeal symbolic thing. He needs to stand up and take a stand on this issue, not verbally, but through action, and show the United States commitment, much the way we here in the state of California have done this. And, you know, in the state of California, we have the same debate about jobs. Californians care about jobs. Californians, you know, use their cars, and everybody in California is driving around, so we have the same concerns as the rest of the nation. But California has a stated and implementable climate policy that is taking forward and showing leadership, and the president needs to do the same thing.
Let me get, looks like Art from Manahawkin, New Jersey, to join us. Art, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a quick question on this. I just believe that the oil is coming here one way or the other. It's just going to be, it's going to go to the Koch Brothers refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas, where they have the high sulfur refinery, which gets the oil from Venezuela as well. or is it going to come by rail, which is controlled by now Warren Buffett. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. What you're saying is it's coming one way or the other, Mike?
That is correct.
What do you think, Susan?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've been taking a look at rail lately because it's sort of been put out there as an alternative if Keystone XL doesn't get built. And it goes to this broader issue that Amy raised about, well, would the tar sands be produced anyway, even without Keystone XL? And, you know, the fact of the matter is that right now the tar sands are kind of landlocked. They're in Alberta. They're going through pipelines to the U.S. Midwest and Rockies and to places in Canada, but they're not able to get to coast for export. And expansion of tar sands, the next wave of development there, really depends on them being able to get their product out to the coast. And what we see is that the pipelines that are, you know, that essentially the people are saying no to are the main way to get them there. Rail is not really an economically viable option for tar sands expansion. It's simply too expensive, and you'd have to build a whole new infrastructure when it comes to, you know, looking at the lack of infrastructure that exists right now for rail up in Canada. You know, one other point, though, I wanted to make also partly in response to Amy is she said several times now Canada has a climate policy. Canada really doesn't have a good climate policy. It's interesting, you know, Canada had, we think of Canada often as being green and environmental and being a good actor on the environment, but that's really changed recently. Canada has a policy to support the oil industry. They've been seen as a laggard on the international stage. They've, you know, backed out of a lot of their commitments to fight climate change. What they do is they make promises, but they don't follow through with action. And it's interesting because the U.S. hasn't made the same kinds of promises, but we're actually seeing more action right now in the U.S.
Meaning that we're doing more about climate than Canada is?
I would argue that the U.S. is taking real steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and Canada is talking about it and then actually trying to undermine international movement on climate change. I think that it's generally seen in the international community that Canada's tar sands oil industry has turned Canada into a bad actor on climate.
Let me get back to our callers. Is it looks like Mike from Phoenixville joining us on Radio Times. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a pipe fitter. I am also a recreational fisherman. So I see both sides of the industry as far as the environmental as well as the jobs. With regards to rail transfer versus pipeline, in southeastern Pennsylvania, there are rail transfer stations being built as we speak in Marcus Hook and at the old Sun South Philly refinery. The question to me, as both an environmentalist and someone who needs a job,
sure,
is how is this going to benefit the larger economy? The Alaska pipeline was a mistake because we exported a lot of that oil. The Pacific Rim emerging economies have lower environmental standards. We should refine the tar sands, which I believe is coming here one way or the other, here for the benefit of the North American market. Worrying about building the export market is only worrying about the corporate bottom line. It's not worrying about the American worker or the environment.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Amy, let me give you a chance to respond to his call first, and then I'll go to you, Susan. Amy?
Well, first of all, the Alaskan oil by law actually stayed here, so I just don't want to confuse the listeners. But I think the bottom line is we have a global market, and in the end, we will have lower prices and more jobs in the United States based on two things. Number one, are our imports lower, right? So when we import less oil and our trade deficit is smaller, that helps our economy, helps the dollar, and so forth. But in addition to that, in terms of the global market, you know, we want there to be an efficient global market. When you have an efficient global market where products move around and you know, free trade or so forth, and you don't have artificial barriers, then you're likely to have lower prices. And so I agree with the caller that the lower our energy prices here in the United States, obviously the, you know, more economic activity we can take place at a lower cost, and so that's good for the economy. But I do believe that is achieved by having an open global market where you have a commodity where it's freely available and therefore You get the synergy of that, and that is actually our best protection. Our best protection against disruption, you know, anywhere in the world is to have there be replacement supplies again anywhere in the world. And so we don't remember this, but during Hurricane Rita and Katrina, Europe loaned us emergency gasoline and diesel from their own supplies because we don't actually stockpile refined product here in the United States. So I don't think we want to be talking about holding, you know, energy materials inside our own country, because we may come to a day where we need to be, you know, a borrower from somebody else. So what we do need to have is a better system, for example, for emergency supply. And it would be a good thing for the United States to regulate our refining industry. You know, in Europe and in Asia, refiners are required to hold minimum product inventories. Instead of just exporting everything out, they're required to hold a particular amount of material in tank in case there is a problem, and there's just no reason why we shouldn't have that same requirement in the United States. One of the reasons why we don't get refinery accidents regulated well enough is that there's this feeling if you take a refinery down for maintenance, it might quote-unquote raise the gasoline price, either in the local area or nationally. And we could obviate that problem by requiring the industry to hold minimum stocks, as they did in Japan, which is why the Fukushima accident would have been an even greater problem for Japan had they not required those stocks.
Let me jump in here. Let me give Susan a chance to respond, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Right. So, you know, I wanted to get back to sort of the underlying point that I think, Mike, that you were making, as somebody who's both a pipe fitter and a fisherman, as somebody who cares clearly deeply about the environment. You know, this is sort of what I think we're all struggling with. How do we craft an energy future for the United States and for the world where we're protecting the environment, you know, we're keeping our rivers clean, we're protecting the health of our children, but we're also having the energy that we need? And, you know, what's clear is that that type of future is not based on fossil fuels. And what we need to be doing is moving as quickly as we can towards cleaner forms of energy, which provide good jobs and are less of a burden on our waters and our air and our health and our climate. And, you know, the good news is that we have these options. These options really exist. One of my concerns, though, is that it's not just a simple matter of letting the markets of supply and demand play out, that the fossil fuel industry has a real interest in keeping their industry sector going. Of course they do. And that rather than becoming energy companies, as they see these newer, more expensive, more extreme, more dangerous and dirty and risky forms of oil around the world, that's what they're going after. And I think we're actually at a moment right now where we need to make some real choices about whether we as the public are going to stand by and let that, you know, dirtier energy choice be our future, or whether we want to be moving very strongly towards the clean energy choices.
Just a quick follow-up on that, Susan, though. But are you saying that we have to choose between, let's say, the Keystone expansion and alternative? Is it possible to have both, or do they end up sort of canceling each other out?
I think that they end up canceling each other out. I think that when we say, you know, if we were to approve dirty energy projects, that's essentially locking us into 50 years, the Keystone XL pipeline, locking us into 50 years of tar sands flowing through that pipeline. It's hard to see industry turning off a pipeline once they open it up. And I think that the way to send a clear message that we need to leave, you know, future expansion of tar sands in the ground as we're moving towards cleaner forms of energy for our transportation and our electricity needs, you know, the way to send that message is to deny the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline.
Let me just jump in here. Let me squeeze Pat in from Mattawan, New Jersey. Pat, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks. I've loved the discussion.
Thanks.
Both guests are very, very sophisticated. And my frustration is, as a listener, I'm looking for some hard numbers. I hear a parade of horribles, of bad things that could happen. Very little in the way of numbers, which makes me think, maybe the arguments aren't as strong as they sound to me intellectually.
And are you seeing this from both sides, Pat? I'm just curious.
I'm seeing this more so from your guest, in California than from your other guests.
Okay, fair enough. Amy Myers Jaffe, the ball is in your court. Go ahead.
An extra 1 million or 2 million barrels a day from the tar sands over the next 5 to 10 years. All the things that Susan's talking about in terms of cleaner energy volumetrically, right now, caller, there are 350 million cars on the road in the United States. We use roughly 18 million barrels a day of oil in this country, of which about half of it is imported. Over time, from the shale formations in the United States, we might add another 3 million barrels a day of oil production in the United States. But ultimately, that is not going to eliminate fully the 8 to 10 million barrels a day that we're using from foreign sources. If we do not come up with an alternative to those sources and we do not change the kind of cars we drive, because with all due respect to Susan, right now there's almost no one in the United States that's using a car that works off of electricity. And so therefore, you know, solar is great and wind is great, but you can't put it in your car. You're not putting a windmill or a solar panel on your car. And so to the extent that we need to drive these cars, we need to have liquid fuel. And right now, there's absolutely almost no alternative to the liquid fuels. Now, here in the state of California, we're trying to switch to electricity. We're trying to promote biofuels. And I can tell you, in the state of California, trying to come up with the number of biofuels, a limited amount of biofuels that have been regulated by the state, is proving very, very difficult.
Well,
so it's a thorny problem.
Indeed it is. And I appreciate the fact that both of you joined us on Radio Times. Amy Myers Jaffe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
She's Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California at Davis, joining us by telephone. Susan Casey Lefkowitz, thank you very much as well.
Thanks so much for having
me. You're welcome. She's Director of the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.